This is True North Story, the original podcast series. Learn, love, listen, live. Are you ready to discover your True North Story? With your hosts, Tama Fulton and John Hudson Messerall.
You are quite the social media maven.
Yes. Well, I'm so glad that you see that. Yeah, I am quite active on social media. It's just so much fun.
John and I have a podcast that we call True North Story. What we like to do is we like to help people find what we call their true north or their purpose and passion in life.
I absolutely love that.
Well, good. We want to help encourage and motivate and inspire our audience through the lives of our guests. I thought you have a pretty incredible life to share about.
You could say that, I guess, in some ways. Well, I hope I don't let your listeners down.
I doubt that you will let them down, Winnie. I'm looking at all of your amazing social and media experience tied to the financial. Let's start a little bit with, maybe you could tell us a little bit about where this passion for finance and your desire to advise others in the area of finance came from.
It was very personal. My parents have always been really great savers. They're first generation to the United States. They came from Taiwan. And about a few months before I was getting ready to start college, my parents came to me and said, honey, you know, we know you studied really hard and whatnot, but we just found out that the partners of ours on this real estate project are declaring bankruptcy. So we are to go into bankruptcy as well. So that is going to factor into what college you go to, especially since my younger sister is just 2 years younger than me. So and that was one of those things that I can look back and say that was probably one of the most stressful times, but also probably one of the biggest gifts that I got to experience as a young adult.
Wow. So let's unpack that a little bit. That has to be stressful. As someone who knows that bankruptcy world a little bit myself in a family business, that is supremely stressful. And it's the unknown, and you don't know. You want to believe you're going to be okay on the other side, but you're not sure. And so to talk a little bit about that, what that was like with your parents and kind of what you learned from that, that then made you more interested in going into financial area.
Well, you know, we were such a small unit and we always lived really modestly anyway. I mean, we didn't know that we didn't have that much money. Let's just put it that way. So my sister and I, we always grew up very, very happy. And our parents did a wonderful job kind of insulating us from these sorts of issues. But when it came down to it, you know, this is right before college, it became a decision very early on that as soon as I was to start college, then it meant not only putting myself through school and working multiple jobs through school, but it also meant whatever I could do to help my parents out financially, to help them keep the house and everything else, that was what we would do. And somehow, some way, we were going to get it done. And so I think that, to me, that was really important. And also, knowing that my parents had a financial advisor who was a family friend, who I felt that didn't give them very much information, and you know, they probably didn't seek it out. And I felt like it was just something that I thought if I could do it again, I would probably get more involved with my parents and trying to help them understand earlier on. And going through college, it never dawned on me that I would go into financial planning. That was the last, I mean, I'd actually never even heard of a financial advisor. Yes, my parents had a Merrill Lynch advisor, but I didn't really know what that meant, you know, because none of my immediate family members were financial advisors. So I did attend UCLA, graduate from UCLA, and during that time, I started working at a television show called Jones and Jury, started working in the television production area, And that's when I actually started my own television audience production company. You know,
How cool was that? It was
quite a wonderful experience. It was owning my own business. It was working with shows such as Wheel of Fortune and Jeopardy and America's Funniest Home Videos, MTV Pilots, Regis and Kathy Lee. Lots of fun things. And we ended up being one of the most successful in our field. So at, you know, 20 some years old, like I think 21, 22, I ran and owned a very, very successful, very busy company while still a student in college. And so financial planning was something that I took upon, frankly, because when there were hiatus periods in television, we didn't have too much to do during that time. I just decided it would be a good thing to get myself to continue to study something. And I just, financial planning really to me was something that I enjoyed, and I thought it would be good information to help my parents with more than anything.
I'm just curious, obviously something creative in you enjoyed being part of a TV production and wanting to be part of this company that you built. What was it about the sector of audience in a show that really drew you? I never thought of that before, but obviously there's a place for audience.
Right?
Yeah.
Well, you know, I went to UCLA's internship office, and I knew I needed to get myself an internship, and ideally something that would pay me something would have been great. But, you know, at the time I was pre-law, so I was political science major. So they set me up at a law firm to intern. I remember being at the law firm, all I did was copy and staple all day long. So I went back to the internship office and I said, maybe not a great use of my time. So is there anything else? And then she said, well, I just got this legal TV show and they need people to do legal research and that might be good for you. So I went to the show, which was Jones and Jury, and I get there and they said, well, we don't have any legal research for you to do today, but we need help in the audience department. So that's kind of how it all started. And I was just happy to have something to do and was able to be useful. So it really wasn't something I looked for. It just kind of fell in my lap.
What does an audience department do on a show?
Well, you know, it's really glamorous. Actually, I should share that with you. So when I first started, I would walk members to and from the restroom, and then I would collect gum from audience members before the taping would start, and I would need to make sure that they clapped with vigor and with energy, and to make sure they sat in their seats if we went long in taping, which was pretty much every day. And that was my duty, and I absolutely loved it because I love talking to people and getting to know them. And then one day, I was, and that's what they call a page. So the page, I got promoted to head page, and then one day the audience producer had medical leave, and one of the producers said, hey, UCLA, so we're going to have you, you know, step in while she's on medical leave. And I said, okay, great. So I did that, and then they said, hey, you're doing such a great job. Why don't you think of starting an audience company, and then we'll send you our shows. And that is really how it started. So I went to the city, got a license. I went to Staples. I bought a floor model fax machine. In my college apartment, or actually my, I think I was still on campus in my college dorm, I started an audience company.
So if I wanted to be on a show, let's just pretend, what do I do and how do you help me?
So back then, how it would work is if you wanted to be an audience member of these shows, like America's Funniest Home Videos, for example, quite popular show, then you would either call into the show and ask for tickets. Or, like what I did is essentially I went out to recruit people because any taping would have anywhere between 100 to, I worked Gladiator, and that was like 600 people per taping. And so you need to make sure you had enough people in those seats that looked the part and who good fans of the show. So I was brought in to recruit audience members. I would go out to different organizations, and even sometimes when we were short, I would hire extras from casting agencies. I would go to universities and colleges and send buses and coordinate food and bring on, like, you know, hundreds of people to shows every single day. They had to be there on time. They had to leave on time. They had to be there. It was, yeah, it was quite a lot of work, but it was an amazing experience.
Did somebody give you some seed money to get started? Because renting a bus and going around and picking people up isn't probably cheap.
It isn't, but no, I've always been, my parents were incredible savers, so I'm an incredible saver. So I started the business with just what I had, my savings, which was probably no more than maybe $1,000, $2,000. I already had experience working in audience, so I would, well, here's, I'll tell you kind of one of my secrets. I figured out that one of the best ways to bring audience members was to get them from schools, like students from schools, right? What I would do is I would mass fax every school in Southern California at night when everybody went home. So by the time they woke up, they would receive a fax from me in the morning saying, we'd love to have you on our show, and in exchange for your time, we'll give you fundraising money just to watch a show. So they would get this, and they would call, and I would arrange for them to have fundraising, and part of the money that I would eventually get paid on the audience would go to cover the bus. So I would just front the money myself, but it wasn't an issue because we were highly efficient. I really didn't have that much trouble filling audiences. Also, I was fortunate because I was handling some very popular shows at the time. Funniest Home Videos, Jeopardy, I handled a lot of the MTV pilots and kids shows and game shows. I pretty much did a lot of what used to be, at that time, reality TV, which is these core shows and talk shows and game shows where people really like watching those shows.
Now, did you get to meet Pat Sajak and Vanna White?
That is one of the flaws of being early 20-some years old and sort of clueless. I didn't do a great job networking with the talent or even the higher-level production teams because really my relationship was mostly with the line producer, who is, in an instance, a person who handles the budget, who, you know, writes the checks and whatnot. So being Asian American and having Asian parents, you're always taught to just be seen and not heard. And so I felt like I didn't want to overstep my role and try to make friends and things. So I just did it that way. So unfortunately, I didn't make a lot of friends in the higher up levels of television. But now I know that probably was. But now, you know, now that I am who I am, and I guess I'm pretty well known in my industry, I've connected with a lot of them on social media. So, yeah, now they know me quite well. Yeah.
That's awesome. I love the idea that you were doing something and then it turned into a business. And we talk a lot about small business in America and that it's struggling. Some feel that kind of the American dream maybe is slipping away a little bit from a standpoint of people being willing to invest the time, energy, and effort required to start a business. And I love that you saw something here, a need, and you turned it into a business. So talk a little bit about personally for you, Winnie, what drives that? Where does that come from? So that other people can try and identify it within themselves to say, hey, you know what? I don't just want to necessarily have a job and collect a paycheck, but I want to maybe own the company one day. What does that look like? What are some of the attributes and traits required or necessary to give them a chance to be successful?
That's a really good question. I think that entrepreneurship, I've heard different people say different things. Some people say it can be trained, and some people say that you're born with it. And I think that as an entrepreneur, as a business owner, as a leader, I think there's a couple of things that cannot be trained. You either have it or you don't. And one of those things is a natural belief that you can. It's an optimism. Like I rarely have bad days. I'm pretty much happy all the time. I don't have a lot much fear in failure. I guess I was fortunate to have the amazing parents that I have, in that I always knew that if it didn't work out, I could go home and live at home. You know, my parents would support me. So that took away some of that fear. The other thing is you have to almost, in many ways, have almost no ego. Like I really, to be completely honest with you, I have very little ego. So if it comes to taking out the trash out and picking up the gum from people's mouths and whatever, and whether it be the homeless person that's asking me to sit on my show because they just need someone warm to sit, like I can talk and make friends with pretty much anybody. And I think when you are running a business and when you start a business, you have to have that level of sensibility that you do whatever it takes to make this work, and you say yes to opportunities. You cannot say no until you've achieved a level of success where you know that you can afford to say no. But when you're first starting off, or even if you're in the early stages of growth, you really need to continue to say yes and see everything as such a blessing and as a gift that people are taking opportunity chance to help you or even give you a chance to prove that you can do what you can do. And you need to show so much gratitude for that opportunity. I think that's the thing, is so many people forget that it isn't other people's job to help you be successful. It's your job, but you need to remember who helped you get there. And that's probably the thing that's helped me now build and continue on two successful businesses. And I think that my parents always taught me to give back.
I absolutely love it. I'm blown away. No ego in Los Angeles. That's hilarious because Tam and I talk all the time about seeing the collective and seeing outside of yourself and seeing the collective as opposed to just what's in front of you and what matters to you. And I just think that's one thing we're trying to do with this podcast too. So I just love that you dipped into that, is that there's a theme that arises with a lot of our guests. And one is you've touched on already, which is the support of their parents. Whether their parents are super supportive, it leads to success, or if they were less supportive, it led to other issues. And so I love to hear that your parents were supportive. But the other thing is that just seeing the collective and being able to see and contribute and collaborate in ways outside of yourself just takes success. And the universe loves that. Mm-hmm. I love your optimism. We can hear it in your voice. So no wonder people want you to help them with financial advice. And you're optimistic, so it's always the best case scenario, right?
Yeah, that's a whole other chapter. And what I do now for my clients, I'm just so grateful that they entrusted me, but I'm really proud of what we've built now, because I do call us kind of like anti-broker, if you will. Like, I feel like I'm defined by the things I don't get paid for my clients. Like, I give you a whole bunch of examples of what I did the last couple of weeks that just make me so proud and happy about what we do, you know.
Like, has it changed? Has the financial advisor role kind of changed from what we traditionally think about, where, you know, we sit down across from you and we give you our $100,000 and you take the $100,000 and go 9 months or a year from now, go, hey, your $100,000 is now $125,000. And we're going to take a percentage of that. I mean, has that relationship changed from what maybe it was for our parents?
Well, that's still certainly the case at most financial advisory firms. I spent 11 years at Smith Barney, and then they were bought out by Morgan Stanley. So I've worked at a very, very large firm for many years, and a great firm. We started our own firm in 2011. Now it's, you know, I've been in the business now almost 17 years. But one thing that I think I'm most proud of is my relationship with my clients is very different and stems much more than what you've described, because what you described is exactly what typically happens. It's quite one-sided if you think about it. You meet with an advisor, you give your forms to an advisor, you give your money to the advisor, and then the advisor gives you information on their schedule. And, you know, of course, that's pretty much it. But I guess I never wanted that sort of relationship with anybody that I worked with. So I feel like what I can do for my clients is not only help them manage their money properly, but also go deeper and find out what it is that is most important and necessary for them to be financially successful. And oftentimes it goes beyond the financial statements. Certainly for many of our clients, they just need us to manage their money and they're in good shape. But there are so many other things that we can do. So I do believe that I have more to give than just to manage money. For my clients, I try to figure out what's eating at them or what I could, like for many of my clients, if I bought them business, for example, if I bought them a new client or a new partnership, that actually could pay them more than I can produce for them in their investments. So what I love to do is supplement and give them more. And if I can arrange for that to happen, that benefits them financially and I have more to manage for them as well. And it really makes me a more important role in their lives. At the end of the day, I think all clients would appreciate that, but unfortunately our industry hasn't been that way. And I really don't care what the rest of the industry does. That's how I do it. So like this week, I negotiated a lease on a new car for my client. I also just introduced my one client to a very famous movie producer who might be using his music in his movie. So those are things I don't get paid for, but that just makes me so happy.
Oh, you get paid for the, that comes back around though.
Even care. That's karma, right? You gotta give people what you would love.
Mm-hmm. You cannot put a dollar amount on that at all. that is about a relationship of trust, and I love that. I love hearing that because Sam and I are all about just trying to see areas where we can collaborate and engage in a meaningful way that's maybe non-traditional or a little untraditional.
Just be a little bit thoughtful and a little bit more caring, and the world will smile back at you, right? And I mean, that's kind of like how you had mentioned earlier. I do have a very large social media reach, and I believe that's because I think in many ways, social media is kind of like, if you're doing it yourself, social media in many ways is like alcohol. So it just amplifies who you really are. So if you give, it will come back to you. You know, so my community that I have on Twitter, for example, the most wonderful, amazing people. And I think it's like attracts like, and every day I'm just grateful that if I'm just I'm just pooped out one day, I can just go on Twitter and just say, oh, it's been a rough day today. And you have all those people like, you know, I understand, you're going to be fine. You know, I love you. It's amazing.
It's like a support system.
This is True North Story, the original podcast series meant to inspire, encourage, motivate, and offer hope. And now back to the program.
You end up being the go-to girl for financials for a lot of the networks. How did that happen for you?
Yes, well, I guess you found that out. Yeah, so I've worked with several large Hollywood movie studios in town for quite a long time. For example, we've worked with employees at DreamWorks now for like the last 11 years. You know, earlier it was just that we would help with some of their stock option choices and do some consulting that way. And through the years, they just trusted us and word spread that we weren't like other financial folks that I met. And I've been told that over, like every day I get told how we're so different. And I say we're because my business partner, Brandon, and I have been partners now in business for 16 plus years. So I guess I've kind of rubbed off on him a lot. really, that's just kind of how we just kind of grew it that way, just by doing things just a little differently, with a little bit more thoughtfulness, a little bit more caring, and just paying so much more attention and trying to find creative ways to make their lives just that much better, right? Whether it be interviewing doggy daycare, which we've done in the past, to all these fun things, you know, and I do a lot of business matchmaking to help different clients. And because of what I do in social media, and since I do appear on a lot of press and news outlets and press, it just gives me more ability to share my amazing clients and what they're doing.
Oh, I love that. You are a connector. You love to see one person or one business meet up with another person or another business and see things grow, and like gardening with people in business, you know? You love to see that happen.
I love that you say that, because I love to garden. You know me. We're like channeling. I can see your eyes, Anna.
Well, Winnie, you are just an amazing person. I can say personally, you are one of a handful of people on LinkedIn to personally wish me a happy birthday. And I just love that. You take these relationships that you have very seriously, and you treat people with a great deal of kindness and respect. And I think that's probably something that maybe you were taught, but it's probably also something that by you doing it, it generates other people to want to be the same way and do those kinds of things too.
That's very kind of you to say. I certainly hope so. I mean, the three people I just hope will be that way. I have three young children, 7 and younger. That's all I can hope, is that they will be that way.
I'm sure they're picking up on all of the good stuff that they see out of you and in your life.
You are so kind.
As you look forward into the future, John and I are part of Gen X, and we are concerned about finances, especially with this big baby boom generation that's getting older and needing more and more care and health care and those sorts of things. And we just look to the future and say, everybody seems to be talking about what the millennials will have or need down the road. But what do we need in the meantime? What's the world look like for us?
Well, you know, that's a good question. I think, you know, I think the oldest Gen X now has just crossed over 50. And so certainly, I think the youngest Gen X is about 37 right now. So certainly this is prime age to be planning for retirement, to get really serious about that. And I think a lot of Gen Xers are focused on things like providing for their children to go to college and whatnot. But right now, it's time to get quite serious about making sure that you put steps in place to save for retirement. It should be absolutely automated, and it should be programmed into your life so you don't have to think too much of it. But most importantly, you have to be prepared for a market change, which I anticipate to happen sooner than later. I think this market is due for a correction. And so financially, you should be ready for that, and you should be not only financially ready, but career-wise, you should be ready and expect it. That's what I would say. If anything, and if you're listening to this, what I would challenge you to do is a couple of things. Number one is to absolutely decrease your spending right now, because you want to, what I call, hoard money. You want to hoard a little bit of money right now in preparation for the change. And this could be, you know, 12 months. It could be 18 months. But either way, you should be prepared. And that way, when there is a correction in the market, that you're able to profit from that, meaning you can put some of that money to work for yourself for long term if you're saving for future retirement needs. The most important thing is in any person's life is essentially two things. It's just a positive and a negative. So positive being like what you bring in income, and negative is what you spend. Ideally, you could beef up and benefit in both sides. That's ideal. But if you can't, then at least make one of those more attractive. Either spend less, or I prefer not to spend less, to tell you the truth. I like my clients still to maintain the lifestyle that they have, but I would like to beef up the income. So if you currently have income, what I mean by beefing up is perhaps you do some consulting work on the side, which nowadays a lot of it you can do online or at home, or you go and take more duties at the office or ask for a promotion or whatnot, but increase what you bring in revenue. And there's no time, like you literally cannot wait 6 months. You should actually do it right away. Like after you hear this podcast, you should you should get serious and start. And you can remember I told you that, because you gotta do this. there's never a bad thing to make more money, right? As long as it's honest money.
That's true.
Exactly. Is the low interest rate or no interest rate environment what's driving all that money to pile into the stock market, where there could need to be a correction, to your point, at some point in the future?
No, it's not could be. It's going to happen. There's going to be a correction. There has to be a correction. But not only that, if you think about it, this interest rate being so low, I mean, that is somewhat concerning, too, because as the economy gets better, then the Fed will increase rates. Why have they not increased rates? So what we're experiencing, and my opinion is somewhat artificial. It actually right now to me feels a lot like 2007, because I work with many people in the creative agencies, and they tend to be the people who will experience this first. Because if you think about it, if you're running a very large company, right, the first thing that you cut is marketing, advertising, these kinds of expenses. So we're already seeing some weakness there, and then companies are starting to close, they're merging, acquisitions occur. So the clock is ticking. The market cannot continue to go for another 10 years and do as well as it's done for the last 7+ years. It's just not rational. It can't happen, right? And it wouldn't be healthy. So correction is normal and healthy, right? It's like cutting your hair. It's got to happen.
And it goes back.
Yes.
Winnie, this is just funny. From back in the day, I used to be real enthralled with finances myself. But I always said there were two kinds of analysis. There was technical analysis, which was the study of trends and history and all of that. And then you looked at the fundamental, which was the financial statements and operations. Mm-hmm. And which one would you put yourself more in? What do you think you utilize more? I mean, maybe that's a loaded question. I don't mean it to be. I'm just curious.
No, please. No, these are all really good questions. I mean, I would say that we definitely follow both here. I'm probably skew a little bit more to fundamentals. The other thing is, I think that it's more than that. I do think at the end of the day, you have to always remember the stock market is essentially two people, right? It's a buyer and a seller. So as much as we focus on fundamentals and technical, which is very, very important, very helpful, we also can't discount what's going out in the world. So, like, for example, this crazy presidential election and how people feel about things plays a very important role in how the market will react as well. And that is hard to quantify technically or fundamentally. You know, I always say, like, I love the fact that I've been through two very significant corrections in the market. I feel like if you're going to find a financial advisor, you want to find someone who has experienced loss, you know, who experienced a downturn, because it makes you so much better investor. But truly, you got to pay attention to all these cues, and you got to watch your neighborhood and you watch real estate and a whole bunch of different trends. So whether the Fed will increase rates, they have to increase rates. It's a smart thing to do. It's not negative. It's going to happen. Just how many and how will the market react to it? That's the biggest question. So I would say I always believe there's no harm in being a little bit more conservative. And I think this is a time to do that. I think, like, for those of you who are extremely bullish, you've been rewarded on your financial statements. So my question to you is, are you going to have something to show for it? And a lot of investors, what they do is they see their money go up and they see their money come down, and they never actually took profit. So taking profit is a very important skill, and what a lot of investors forget to do. And since you're listening to this amazing podcast, I challenge you to consider doing that for yourself.
That's awesome. That's like the Matthew McConaughey thing in the Wolf of Wall Street, where he talks about keeping the people on the Ferris wheel. They never if you never cash out, I mean, you're just constantly in the money, and it's like you double down, and it's like you never take any chips off the table. That's your point, right? I mean, you know, at some point,
exactly.
It's all just on paper.
And I think, our industry could do a better job, in my opinion, to taking profit. I think it's very, very important, and something that we need to, you really need to think about doing. And so if you see some great positive numbers, consider rebalancing, reviewing your portfolio, because every year you get a little bit older. So your allocation should reflect that, and to stay aligned to what you're trying to do. And especially since right now we're at the end of the year, you should also be looking at sheltering more from taxes, right? Because a lot of people put so much focus on returns and fees, but you realize that the less you pay in taxes, that's an immediate and greater return than all the other little things you're talking about. They're not fees, and return isn't little. But if you think about it, if you're able to shelter something from taxes, and let's say people are at least in a 28% tax bracket, that's something you cannot discount. So I think financial planning and strategy is very, very important when managing money, in addition to obviously returns and fees and whatnot.
Obviously, that's a huge issue for small business owners who want to keep their companies going or want to transition them to the next generation. It's a whole other thing you got to think. It's like, well, how do we do that in the death of the founding member or a parent who started the business? And then there's this big tax that has to be paid just for your next generation to be able to continue to operate the business.
Exactly. That estate tax is something that a lot of people don't realize. That's a huge number. Whether you have to pay it or you're children have to pay it, nonetheless, it's coming from money that you've already been taxed on. You have to think about that for a second. So, Sean, like, the end of the year, you should consider doing gifting. You should be really smart and talk to a financial advisor to do some strategy right now, because actually it's really the best time, because a lot of accountants aren't quite as busy right now. And financial advisors, I mean, this is what we live to do anyway. So if you do the strategy and put things into place, that just means more money in your pocket. It's a beautiful thing.
I love how positive you are at the end of the day, Winnie. You just...
It is, Tam. It's the optimism thing. I mean, she mentioned earlier about culturally being seen and not heard. And I love the way that you've totally flipped that around, because you are not, you're seen a lot and you're heard a lot now. So that's, like, really awesome.
And you'll never believe this. And I don't think I've ever talked about this, but I'm actually, my husband will attest to this, I'm actually naturally extremely introverted.
You know, I think most people who are out there are. And I think that when it's a platform that you are confident in and that you love and are passionate about, you can talk to it in a really engaging way. And you have done that. in spades, Winnie Sun. You sure have. If people want to find out more about you and about your business, how do they find you?
Well, probably the easiest way is how we connected is to find me on LinkedIn. You can just type in Winnie, like Winnie the Pooh, and Sun, like Sun in the Sky, and that's me. Or you can actually, so if you go to winniesun.com, that takes you to our website, too. So I would be absolutely tickled to talk to anybody who wants to talk.
That's great. The name of your business is?
Sun Group World Partners is our firm.
Okay. And people can find you and Brandon there as well, I'm sure.
Yes, we are there.
Not to mention all over the financial media and the regular media. And she writes for lots of publications, digital and otherwise.
Follow me on Forbes. Yeah,
that's right. You are a Forbes contributor.
Yeah, for a few years now.
Mm-hmm. Wall Street Journal, CNBC, New York Times, Yahoo, HuffPo, The Street. What aren't you writing for, Winnie? What aren't you contributing to?
Well, I've had to say no a few times because really writing does take a lot of time. It's pretty easy to find me. If you Google me, I'm actually pretty easy to find. Actually, it's funny. My girlfriend just told me they just got this Alexa system put in for her smart home, and it says, who is Winnie's son? If you ask them that, they can tell you. I know, ask Alexa.
Winnie, thank you so much for sharing your True North story with us. We just love talking to you. You're a very kind and engaging person, and I hope that everyone takes your advice and reads in Forbes about you and starts either making more or saving more. How about that?
I love that. And join me in listening to True North because I love this. Thank you.
Thank you for listening to True North Story, the series. Follow us on Twitter @True North Story. And tune in next time for another True North Story.